Welcome to Division 7 of the Court of Appeals. We have one case on our docket today at 10 a.m., and that is GSCRP versus Geotech Corporation. The parties will each have 15 minutes aside to argue. The appellant, if they wish, may reserve part of their 15 minutes. There is a time clock. When the light turns yellow, it means you have 5 minutes remaining. If you have any cell phones, please turn those off so as not to interrupt the argument. And if the parties are ready, we can begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Forbes on behalf of the appellants in this case. Your Honors, this case presents, in our view, two issues. One issue is whether the trial court properly entered a default sanction under the standards set forth by the Colorado Supreme Court in the Pinkstaff case, Pinkstaff versus Black and Decker. The second issue is whether, if the trial court did properly enter that sanction, in other words, you find that there was no abuse of discretion, that the trial court did in fact follow the procedures and the standards and principles set forth in Pinkstaff, the trial court nonetheless erred in holding the non-geotech defendants liable for the amounts due under the geotech note. I just want to take a few minutes just to give us some context as to what happened in the case. Essentially, this is a case involving a failed real estate venture. There were numerous transactions, but essentially what ultimately happened is that there was a 14-acre parcel. It was actually close to 15 acres. It was broken down into 11-acre parcel that was going to be developed and a 4-acre parcel that was going to be swapped with the City of Colorado Springs for some open space land as part of the transaction. The appellee, GS Corp, had a first deed of trust on that 4-acre parcel. The arrangement between the parties was that GS Corp would release that first deed of trust when certain conditions were met in order to facilitate this land swap, which in turn would facilitate the development of the 11-acre parcel. The Geotech made a request to the title company to arrange for release of the GS Corp deed of trust on the 4-acre parcel. The title company sent the paperwork to GS Corp. GS Corp sent the paperwork to the title back to the title company. The title company apparently lost it. There was then a lengthy period of time that went by, probably about 6 months, until the title company itself recorded a release. That recording of the release left GS Corp essentially unsecured on that 4-acre parcel property. The condition, and I think this is undisputed, the condition for effecting that release on the 4-acre parcel had not occurred. GS Corp then filed this action originally seeking, number one, to collect from Geotech the amounts due under the promissory note, and number two, seeking to reinstate its deed of trust on that 4-acre parcel.
I understand, at least from the briefs, that the reason the city didn't accept the 4-acre parcel was because of an easement that one of the defendants had. Was there any effort made to have that easement released?
I think the record shows that the effort that was made was to convince the city that the easement did not have to be released, because the Geotech's position was the city had approved the development plan showing the easement, and so they were taking that position. The easement was not released. The easement was eventually released, but not before the suit was filed.
Was the holder of the deed of trust informed that the city had declined to take the transfer because of the easement?
Your Honor, I think the record on that was that, well, actually, we don't know. For purposes of this appeal, we have to assume that they were not, because the court of default, and the allegation was they were not so informed. So, Your Honor, the case then proceeded really in fits and starts. I think the record shows that no party made timely disclosures in this case. GS Corp finally made disclosures 3 weeks before the discovery cutoff. We made disclosures at the end of this discovery cutoff. So there was kind of a languid or a languor among all parties in pursuing this case. GS Corp, that gets us to the issue in this case, GS Corp never filed anything saying our disclosures were inadequate. There was never a complaint about the disclosures in this case. There was an issue, however, with respect to some written interrogatories and some written requests for production. And that's really the first issue in this case, because on the morning of trial, the trial court heard argument and ruled that it would enter a default sanction for failing to respond to the written discovery. And actually, that's...
But that was after an order to compel had already been issued.
Yes, I have to correct myself. There were responses. They were deemed inadequate, and the trial court said, they are inadequate, I'm going to compel additional responses to the discovery. So that's where we find ourselves, is at the morning of trial. There was a motion to compel. It was granted. Supplemental responses were not given. The question then becomes whether under Pinkstaff, the trial court, in the circumstances of this case, could and did properly enter default sanction. And I think Pinkstaff says two things on that. Number one, Pinkstaff says, and I think pretty clearly, that the mere fact that you have not complied with a trial court order compelling discovery, even when it's willful, is not sufficient to establish the level of culpability to justify entry of a default sanction. And Your Honor, when you look at Pinkstaff on page 701, it specifically says the trial court found that there was noncompliance with its discovery orders in that case. And on page 704, the Supreme Court acknowledges that there was willful noncompliance. But the Supreme Court pointed out that there had not been a complete abdication of the party's responsibilities.
In this particular case, what do you suggest would have been an alternate, less sanction that would be meaningful?
Well, Your Honor, I think that under Pinkstaff, one has to look at the various claims at issue to find out what type of prejudice the plaintiff actually suffered to determine what would be a meaningful alternate sanction.
As I understood it, the trial court here observed that the documents that were not produced were the very documents that plaintiff would have to rely upon to prove the fraud claim.
Your Honor, this is a good question. The question is, what was the fraud claim? All right, because what they've said, and remember, we had default entered not just on the fraud claim, but we had default entered on all claims, okay? And you're right, there was no showing that there was in other words, they got on the reformation claim or the reinstatement claim, which was really the central thrust of the complaint. They, I think, acknowledged that they got all the documents dealing with the city from the city, et cetera. So the first point, I think, on that is that there wasn't uniform prejudice across the board, and the trial court didn't try to segregate all the claims. Now, with respect to your specific question on the fraud claim, Your Honor,
let me ask you this first. As I understand it, there was no dispute with respect to the claim based upon the promissory note, am I correct?
Correct. The promissory note was in default, and in the trial management order, those facts were stipulated. So that
okay. Fair enough.
All right. I think what they've argued on appeal is we had a fraud in the inducement claim, that misrepresentations were made about who owned Geotech, about who owned Trend, and we were induced into doing this transaction by misrepresentations about the ownership. But when you look at the First Amendment complaint, which is the document where that claim was first asserted, there are no allegations in that complaint of any fraudulent misrepresentation concerning those specific matters.
Mr. Forbes, is that true with the conspiracy complaint as well?
Yes, the conspiracy claim is all of three paragraphs that just says they agreed or by words or conduct to accomplish the above unlawful goals and to accomplish lawful goals or lawful goals through unlawful means as discussed above. So there's nothing in the conspiracy claim that even identifies specifically what the issues are. So when we look back at the fraud claim, There, in paragraph 65, this is the fifth claim for relief, there is a statement that Massey represented she was the sole owner of Geotech and Trent. It doesn't say she falsely represented that. It just says she represented that. Then the next complaint says Massey recently represented that Flanders owned Geotech and Trend throughout the relevant time. Again, there's no allegation of false representations. And so then after that, the entire fraud claim relates to the transaction involving getting release of the deed of trust on that 4-acre parcel.
In paragraph 88 of the amended complaint, it's alleged that these defendants knew the representations were false or were aware that they did not know whether the representations were true or false. And that's, as I read it, one of the representations is in fact that Massey represented that she was the sole owner, and also that she later represented that Flanders, in fact, owned both Geotech and Trent.
Okay, and so I'm not sure that gives notice of a fraudulent inducement claim, particularly when you look at the nature of the damage claim. But I'd also point out that in the trial management order, which was signed and which then fixed the claims for trial, there was no allegation in that, no indication in that, that even if they pled such a claim, they were maintaining it. And the trial management order specifically, on that point, and then I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal, specifically on that point, refers to a misleading by facts, including, and everything relates to disclaiming the deed on the, just concealing the city had disclaimed the deed, concealing they'd recorded the easement, concealing that the city had refused to accept the open space parcel. So even if there was such a claim pled, which we don't think there was, it was the trial management order, which was signed, and these were the only claims before the court at the time it entered the sanction, did not have such a claim in it. I'll reserve.
Can I ask you one real quick question? With respect to the status of the judgment, as I understand that there was a foreclosure that took place later.
And yes.
And there's presumably a deficiency amount.
Yes.
Is it your position that the net judgment then upon which at this point all the defendants are liable is that net amount after foreclosure, as opposed to the entire amount?
If the court does not vacate the default on the on our defenses, yes.
Thank you.
But you have about 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Honor.
Good morning. My name is Jim Bain. I represent GSCRP. As the court knows, the appellants are focusing their argument on the Pink Staff case. Of course, the trial court didn't have the benefit of the Pink Staff case because it hadn't been issued yet. Nevertheless, the trial court did address the three main issues in Pink Staff. The first one was considering the range of sanctions. The second one was considering whether the sanctions were proportionate to culpability. And the third one was whether the sanction was proportionate to prejudice. The trial court went through all those. It clearly, without question, considered the range of sanctions. You can see both in the trial court's order and on the transcript that the court did at the end of the hearing that the trial court went through all of the sanctions. It weighed some of them, considered whether they were appropriate. The court considered the other sanctions inappropriate. The court also spent a fair amount of time going through culpability. The court found that the Geotech defendants, actions in the case and in discovery were not substantially justified. Rather, they are willful and in bad faith. The court found that the defendants had flagrantly disregarded their discovery obligations. Indeed, they had objected to every request in the four sets of discovery to each of the defendants, even the pattern interrogatories approved by the Supreme Court and in the rules. They basically answered none of the discovery responses. They did have some partial answers, but no proper answers. And unlike Pink Staff, in this case, the court, as this court knows, first ordered a sanction in the motion to compel. They granted the motion to compel, they awarded fees, And that had no effect at all. It didn't get any answers to discovery. It didn't get a motion for an extension of time. It didn't get any effort to comply at all. So now we're faced with not having any discovery on the first day of trial. Well, on the prejudice issue, the court specifically found in its order that the sanction was proportionate with the prejudice. That's in paragraph 10 of the court's order. And I think the reason that the court did that is that it couldn't be remedied. The prejudice from no discovery couldn't be remedied at the beginning of the trial.
Could you just summarize the information that had not been disclosed, which you contend was critical to the proof of the plaintiff's case?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, there was not one document produced, not one. We're trying to prove a fraud and conspiracy claim, which, of course, is going to be almost always based on internal documents. We did have the transaction documents because we got them from other people. We got none of the internal documents, none of the communications among the defendants, none of how they put the deals together. We know things like they Trend acquired, purchased, supposedly, the property at issue for $4 million. Trend had $6,000 in its account. We don't know when Mr. Flanders owned these companies. We don't know when they were transferred. We don't know how they were transferred. Basically, as Mr. Forbes indicated in paragraph 65 of the amended complaint, we said Ms. Massey induced us to loan this $280,000 and apparently didn't own the property. We really don't know. They refused to give us any documents. So
can you respond to Mr. Forbes' statement that there was no allegation of fraud in the inducement that survived up to trial?
I believe the court can read paragraph 65 every bit as well as I can. I think that's what that paragraph says. It's reiterated in the trial brief. It's reiterated in the proposed findings of fact. It seems relatively clear to me that there was a fraud claim, the damage measure being how much was loaned. Of course, on damages, there's two different approaches to it. There's the contract claim, which is it was due under the note, and then there was the tort claim. We were entitled to recover what was fraudulently induced, both under the conspiracy and the fraudulent concealment and the fraudulent.
Certainly, it seems to me that would be true in the case of a trial, but where the judgment is based upon a default, how can you go behind the management order?
Well, as the court knows, the defendants are arguing that the trial management order cut off or we abandon the claims. Mm-hmm. Well, I just don't think that's what Rule 16 provides. Rule 16.3, I think it's Section F3, requires a brief statement of the matters at issue and a summary of the claims. The focus of that rule is what claims are being removed. Matter of fact, both the note and the language of the rule say, if a claim is being withdrawn, so stated in the trial management order. I think all practitioners would be shocked if you had to put in the trial management order every element of a fraud claim. In other words, if there is,
I'm sure that's not the result of your argument, counsel.
Well, if there's a fraud claim based on five different issues. Clearly, you don't have to put all five in there. You have to put fraud in your trial management order. If you're withdrawing it, Rule 16 says you have to notify it, but it doesn't. You don't have to detail it because that's not what the purpose of Rule 16 is. It's a summary listing of the claims, and clearly they were in there. Any issue would be removed by the trial brief and the proposed findings if there was any question about it, because they detail the fraud and the conspiracy. They clearly require joint and several liability under the conspiracy claim. Does that answer your question? The other issue, Mr. Forbes argued, is that in determining prejudice, you should evaluate it on a claim-by-claim basis. I don't know any of the cases that require that. The trial courts have to determine prejudice, but not on a claim-by-claim basis. As indicated before, the contract claim, that is the note claim, that was going to go forward in any event because they had admitted they hadn't paid. It was a default and were entitled to a foreclosure. The discovery was not provided on the fraud and conspiracy claims. I mean, really, not a single document, even though those defendants were parties to all the transactions. They were involved in all the actions. They did everything, but we didn't get a single document from them.
Well, Mr. Bain, let me ask you this. Because you're stating that the importance is that you didn't receive any documents, you're stating that the nature of this case is really a document case, and that is why the sanction was appropriate. Yet at the same time, you're saying we shouldn't look at it at a claim-by-claim basis, which would be looking at the nature of the case. So my question to you is, do we look at the nature of the case to see whether the sanction was proportional?
If I understand, there were two different types of claims in the case. There was the claims on the note, the deed of trust, that we really didn't need documents. We had the documents. They admitted that they hadn't paid. The portion of the case that we needed documents and we needed information was on the fraud and conspiracy claims. Does that make sense? And indeed, we had sent four different sets of discovery and got nothing. Even on the initial disclosures, they say, well, we comply with initial disclosures, but if you look at them, the initial disclosures is just a listing of the witnesses who had previously been identified by the other parties. Really added nothing, and it was basically copying them. Not a single document was identified in the initial disclosures. And of course, Rule 26A requires, even if they'd already been produced, Rule 26A requires all of the documents, your custody, possession, and control relating to the disputed issues be provided. We didn't get any of those. On the complaint issue, there's two other points I'd like to make. And first, obviously in Colorado, we're dealing with notice pleadings. So you don't have to detail everything. We had a claim for fraud, we had a claim for conspiracy. Had the case proceeded to trial, there's also Rule 15B. Could have been an amendment if the evidence had varied from the pleading. So there's a lot of ways that all of this information would have come in. I think that the complaint clearly covered fraud and inducement, but it was a notice pleading situation. Basically, the only discovery that was provided was Ms. Massey's deposition. That was cut short after 3 hours. So we had a three-hour deposition. That was the discovery they provided. In that, she admitted that they had documents concerning many of these topics, but we never received them. I would propose that the disclosure and the discovery in this case was less than the Cornelius case, in which the Supreme Court affirmed the sanction of default. Indeed, in Cornelius, there was some, seemed to me, fairly significant mitigating factors. It was a pro se defendant who wasn't particularly familiar with this. And the defendant had asked for a continuance, which was denied. But the Supreme Court didn't think that those were sufficient to overrule the trial court's discretion in granting the default. As far as damages goes, the complaint from the beginning seeks to recover, among other things, the $280,000 that was loaned. I think that the complaint in paragraph 65 and 88 and 109 all covers that as the damages for the fraud and conspiracy. I think it's relatively clear that if Ms. Massey had revealed that Mr. Flanders had been involved, my clients wouldn't have loaned the money. They don't do business with convicted felons. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Had they known that, they would not have loaned the money. And I think that's relatively clear. That would have been the damages that would have come out of the trial. From an initial complaint seeks to recover the $280,000. The initial disclosures did, the trial management order did, the trial brief did, the proposed findings did. So, sort of in conclusion, it seems to me that there's no question but GSCRP raised a fraud claim and a conspiracy claim. They sought to recover damages for that, including the $280,000 that they loaned. The defendants were jointly and severally liable under the conspiracy claim. Accordingly, it seems that the trial court's sanction was not manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. It's supported in the record, so therefore we'd seek an affirmance of it.
Do you agree with Mr. Forbes that to the extent that there was the foreclosure, that the liability of all these other defendants is also reduced, and it's only the net amount of the deficiency?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay.
To make several quick points. Number one, in terms of damages, Mr. Bain has said that TMO didn't have to set forth the nature of the fraudulent allegations. I disagree. I think Rule 16 says you do have to set forth. But even if it doesn't, Rule 16F3(5) says you have to itemize the damages you're seeking. When you look at the TMO in this case, the only damages they're seeking, it says GSCRP seeks to recover under the note. There are no damages that it says it's seeking to recover from the defendants. At the trial, at the conclusion of the hearing, I said, we're entitled to participate if they're seeking damages. I said, I don't think that they do intend to seek damages. I think that they got all the equitable relief. And, Your Honor, I guess all they've got to do is establish what their note balance is to see if there's any deficiency. Mr. Bain then said, the damage claim, Your Honor, is just the amount due under the note. He didn't say there are damages against anyone.
But the amount due under the note is not, as I read it, and that's confined to or claiming that it's owed under the note by these individuals.
Well, you don't
owe. Still damages owing based upon the deficiency under the note, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, because they didn't say we're seeking to establish damages on conspiracy. They just said we're seeking to recover under the note. That's what they said. And there's no itemization of any other damages. So that we were not on notice, and even if we were on notice from the complaint, they in the TMO specifically said that they are, that the only damages they're seeking are those under the note, which is only a claim against GS Corp. The second point I'd like to make is that the claim-by-claim analysis, and this goes to Judge Criswell's question, were there other sanctions? Of course. Let's take the fraud claim. Questions of reliance. That has nothing to do with any answer we gave or didn't give. That is strictly whether they relied based on their own conduct. The court could have entered specific findings. There is, we're going to find you made misrepresentations. We're going to default you on that. We're going to default you that you made them intentionally. But we didn't prejudice them at all in showing reliance.
Well, how do you prove reliance if you don't know, if you don't have any evidence of the fraud?
Because the fraud is deemed established. It's deemed established that you've made misrepresentations.
Well, if you're talking about the nature of the fraud, you're saying that the trial management order restricted them in terms of the nature of the fraud.
You're right. I'm saying they didn't plead this fraud and inducement claim, or they released it in the trial management order.
Yes.
They do allege in paragraph 89 that GSCRP justifiably relied on these representations, which approximately caused the
correct
damages.
But our failure to respond to discovery didn't prejudice them in establishing reliance. That is strictly their own conduct. So the court could have said, I'm going to deem established. You made fraudulent representations. I'm going to deem established that you made those with specific intent. I'm going to deem established that it was justifiable. But questions of materiality. Materiality, you look at the course of conduct of the parties. What was the party interested in finding out? You look at that based on what they did. Reliance, you look at what the party did. What did they actually look at? What did they actually consider? Those are elements where there was no prejudice from this discovery, even if one is a discovery violation, even if one assumes that there that the claim was properly pled.
Thank you, counsel. Unless there are more, do you have another question?
I was just going to ask, is there a case in Colorado that you know of by an appellate court that approves or suggests a sanction of the nature you're describing?
Where you deem facts established?
Well, where you deem a certain element of a claim established, but not other elements.
I think it's, I think there are, but you know, I can't tell off the top of my head, but I certainly know that the rule says you can deem specific facts established.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments, and the case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court will be in recess. Thank you.